Right, I'll reconvene the hearing. Ms. Hill. Hello again.
Good morning, commissioners. Now, I've got copies of legal submissions which were lodged yesterday. Do you want each of those?
We've already got copies of those. So.
Okay, great. So, the first thing I'll do then is you would have noticed that in my legal submissions I have appended a refined zoning boundary map.
Yes.
And,
yes, it would be useful if we had that at A3 because we can scale up.
Yes, yeah, and that's actually just had another minor modification too, so I'll begin by picking that up and talking to that.
So this is revised from what is attached to your submission, is it?
Slightly, yes. So I'll just talk you through the revision. Now, on the map which was appended to the legal submissions, if you look towards the southwest corner of the site, where it sort of curves towards the Glenorchy Paradise Road,
yes,
you'll see that on the revised map, it has been edged off, I guess, to follow the terrestrial boundary,
yes,
and then where the top of the escarpment protrudes into the cadastral boundary, the zone follows that.
Could I? I had a question about that. Not a legal question, really a planning question about whether that's sensible or not. Whether the zone boundary should just follow the cadastral boundaries, and if those areas are not sensible to be built on, just identify them as not being sensible to build on, rather than this wiggly bit of zone boundary, which at the end of the day is almost impossible on the planning maps to tell where it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I can defer to Mr. Ferguson on that point, but I think there are a couple of ways to skin the cat in this, really.
Yeah.
And the intent is actually, as you say, the same, to ensure that.
This isn't the only place where we have this raised. Mr. Goldsmith had a client with a similar situation, and he said that they were prepared to have it either follow the boundary or have a building restriction area on those places. And I presume that the same sort of thing would be your client's position here.
Yes, I mean the outcome's the same essentially. So the commissioner minded that that's a simple way for administration.
I think it was just more that one approach is to put a building restriction area identified on the planning maps.
Mm.
The building restriction area would have to be aligned to the public terrace.
Yes.
So that introduces a degree of information you can't flow on the district plan anyway that's related to the top of the terrace. So whether you do it that way, which is equally appropriate, or whether you just leave it as a zone boundary aligned to the top of the terrace.
Or do you have a rule that says you can't build on land that's steeper than X? Because there's only two places and there must be a gradient that's...
That could be another possibility.
Would
they're obviously very steep, just looking at...
Yeah, they are reasonably steep. It's just a normal sort of terrace escarpment, isn't it? And so either way, the mapping, sort of had to provide for the top of the escarpment somehow. I hadn't thought of that possibility around a gradient limitation, but that could be another way of doing things.
Yes, because that would be only two places in the site where that would occur.
But it would need to be a setback from that gradient, though, wouldn't it? Because it's a 20-metre setback from the top of the escarpment.
Or a 20-metre setback from the new zone boundary, which is aligned to the pedestal boundary, which would kill any problems of visibility, wouldn't it?
Well, no, that, I think that's the problem. Yeah. The cadastral boundary doesn't quite match with the top of the it slips off the edge, which takes it back to the
position. I don't have my scale rule with me. I'm hoping you do. Can you could tell us how deep those two little areas are on the pedestal boundary?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a scale at all, sorry. What's the question, sorry?
Did you not have a scale at all?
I did scale it off, I didn't bring my ruler today, but we're talking about...
The two little areas of steep escarpment that come into the zone, how deep are they? Are they 20 metres, 50 metres?
Well, 20 metres is, if you look at the paper road, the Glenora Key Paradise Road, that you can use that as comparison as 20 metres.
Well, they're about 20 metres.
I mean, the gradient rule could deal with the exit. So we've got... We've been around for round circles on those. You've got the two lights that come in, but you've got the third area, which is the... which was into the light out.
No, where the road comes in.
Which is where the road... Which is logically where the road would come in, and it's where the current farm track comes in. So, one possibility would be to do a third bite that came around there, but then that quickly becomes redundant as soon as you construct a road and then the edge of the terrace changes when you do the changes to create the road. So that becomes somewhat artificial. So the appeal of this, a slope, could help resolve that part of the zone there as well. But ultimately, you've got to sort of then do the setback from the top of that slope. And that, I think that was the important part about the evidence from Dr. Reed, was the 20-metre setback from the top of the escarpment edge. And I think my preference from a planning and an administrative point of view is that if you can actually align the top of the boundary of the zone to the top of the escarpment, it makes that measurement a reasonably easy process to do.
There's probably nothing in it actually, because in either case, if you're looking at a plan on a computer screen, which is how it's looked at, you're going to have a wiggly line that you have to be 20 metres from, whether it's a zone boundary or a building.
Or building setback, you're still going to have a wiggly line.
The building restriction area.
The
small one. Yeah. It's going to be the same outcome, whichever way it's dealt with.
Yeah, I guess we're reliant on. In some ways on the accuracy of the mappings that it's going to properly to the beginning, and the ability to extract that data from the council's GIS, hopefully, once the model has been published.
Is there any way that you could give us an indication of what the gradient of the terrace space is?
Sure, but yes.
Because that would, another obvious way, given that most of the land is pretty flat, you could say that between you need any way anywhere where terrace props at a gradient, the land props at a gradient of X or more. Anyway,
really jumped into some detail.
That jumped into the plan.
Halfway through my submissions as well.
That's the problem, you see, lawyers would never give planners plans.
Right, okay, well, I guess it set up some useful context about what one of the key issues are, and I think to take away from that conversation, it comes down to the intention of council and submitter are aligned, and that's to protect the sensitive landscape of the terrace escarpment and ensure an appropriate setback, and however we do that, for administration purposes or the most efficient rule framework, and we can work through that and provide some options. So, if I may, commissioners, I think it might be best if I, since we've got quite a bit of time this morning, if I might take you through these submissions. I won't read them word for word, but I will.
You don't have to waste it, I've got other things to do.
There are a couple of matters in the submissions I just would like to draw your attention to. So, starting off with paragraph 3, as we've already discussed, the council's position and the submitter's position are in the majority aligned that it is appropriate to extend the RR zoning over the majority of the site. My second point there is that the existing ODP and PDP provide approximately the same area of land, so it's been rolled over, and it's 15 hectares of zoning over the site. And then I go in here to provide a theoretical calculation of the yield for that area of RRZ zoning. And based upon a gross calculation, I determined that it would be 37.5 residential allotments derived from 15 hectares. Now, I turned to flesh out that calculation a little bit further in my submissions, and about sort of rounding that down, I guess, to provide for access. But I think the key thing here is that Dr. Reid's yield analysis of a deduction of 32% for open space and roading, in my submission, is not necessarily an appropriate percentage deduction for RR zoning. So I'll flesh that out in a moment in the next section of my legal submissions, but I'll carry on with this introduction for now, that there are no submissions opposing the RR zoning over the site, and no submissions seeking a lesser amount of yield than that which could be provided for in the PDP of 15 hectares of RR zoning. So in my submission, that leads to a consideration that there's not actually scope for the council's position that the zone only allow for a maximum of 26 rural residential allotments. But more importantly, is actually that recommendation of 26 isn't actually an effects-based recommendation or based upon landscape concerns. So the submitter has requested relief to rezone the entire site, which over 28 hectares, in theory, could yield quite a higher number of RR allotments than 36. However, the submitter's revised relief to cap the site to a total of 36 is primarily based upon two factors. The first and most important factor being landscape evidence, that being effects-based evidence to support that outcome as being appropriate on the site. And Mr. Skelton's concern is to hand up some further plans that he's done to model what that could look like and the site's absorption capability. And the second basis of that 36 allotments is also a figure being consistent with the existing rights of yield under the ODP and PDP. And that's the calculation which I've touched on briefly, but I will again return to. Now, just to round that off, I submit that there's also no traffic evidence before the panel, which identifies adverse effects from the submitter's now refined relief of 36 allotments. And if there were, this would actually be contrary to the council's determination to roll over the zone from the ODP into the PDP, and keeping that same area of 15 hectares without a limitation on cap. And then finally, there's no infrastructure, ecological or hazard evidence raised in concern, either from the council or submitters in respect of this rezoning. So then on section 5 of my submissions, I turn to a quick summary of the submitter's revised relief, and you'll see there that the additions to the RRZ for this particular site will really introduce three areas of control. The first being controls over height restrictions, so a restriction to 5.5 metres of height over the site, setback controls from the zone boundary, or whether it would, as we've just discussed, that might be a building restriction area or something similar. And then the final matter, which is possibly the most contentious, or maybe the only contentious matter now, is the limitation of the maximum density over the site. So there in paragraph 7, I've noted just the two outstanding issues. First being the appropriate mechanism for treatment of the escarpment. And I think we've already discussed that in quite a lot of detail. And then the second being maximum yield for the zone. Now, page 3 of my submissions talks through that first issue, and perhaps from our introductory conversation, I don't need to take you through this further, except just to say, again, I think there are a number of ways which, in the planning framework, you could provide for the treatment of the escarpment edge, and The simple fact is that the council's landscape evidence from Dr. Reid agrees that a 20 metre buffer from the escarpment edge is the appropriate figure for landscape treatment, and the submitter also agrees that that's an appropriate figure.
Can I interrupt you there just for a minute? We just thought about another subtle way you might do this. Just to confirm that that wiggly line is based on a contour. Mm. Presumably a number can be put to that contour.
It does change. Okay. If the land slopes away, then the contour slopes away as well. So for instance, in the most northern part of it, I was just looking at this, you have about 355 is the top edge of the escarpment. Then as you go down, 355 is quite small to see. But as you go down farther, then the contour is actually lower to the south.
I was going to suggest a rule that you just said no buildings within 20 metres of such and such a contour.
Yes, complex.
Or the boundary, whichever, or the zone boundary, whichever is the greater. Think about it.
Yeah.
Okay,
so there's a 1,000 possible
ones. Yes, well, I've noted down 3 alternatives now, so we will consider that further. And I'll defer to Mr. Ferguson to perhaps discuss with you about the efficiency and effectiveness of the various options as well. So then that leads us to probably the crux of the outstanding issue, and that's commenced discussion on page 4 of my legal submissions. And this is the total yield over the zone. So in my submission, the council's case is not based upon a landscape or a fixed-based assessment of the environment, but rather an application of an estimated yield over the existing zone and reference to what is the existing consent over the zone. And those two factors have led to Dr. Reid's recommendation, and which is relied upon by the Section 42A report writer's recommendation, that the appropriate maximum yield for the site is 26 allotments. Now, as I've already touched on, the submitter, through evidence exchange, refined the proposal to offer up a maximum cap of 36 residential allotments. So I turn first there to discuss a little bit about the council's reasoning to get to 26 allotments. Now, Dr. Reid's yield calculation is based on a deduction of 32% for open space and roading and other infrastructure. Now, in my submission, that is not necessarily an appropriate formula for calculating yield over the RR zoning, and that's because of the size of the minimum allotments being 4,000 metres squared in that zone. It naturally provides for amenity and open space and reserve anyway in the zone. And in my submission, it would be quite unlikely that additional reserves would be required to be provided for in an RR zoning with a minimum size of 4,000 metres squared. Now, in the second half of my paragraph A there is what I need to spend a little bit of time talking through, because I've stated that the most appropriate yield is therefore a gross calculation, which would lead to an outcome of 37.5 residential allotments. And then I go on to state that figure is also comparable to a figure from a previous resource consent granted in 2004 showing feasibility of 36 lots. Now, I think it just needs to be clarified with the Commission that having gone back and looked at that consent again this morning, the 36 lots were not all rural residential lots. But nonetheless, that point is somewhat ancillary to the submitter's main point deriving 36 lot yield, which is, in my submission, a potentially realistic outcome for determining yield in an RR zone. Now, if you divided 15 hectares by 4,000 metres squared, you arrive at a figure of 37.5. If you then round that down to 36, that leaves you approximately 6,000 metres squared for a road. Now, in an RR zone, which is quite a small area of land anyway, we don't know exactly what the layout of a future subdivision might look like, but it might well be feasible that it could be serviced by right-of-ways or a road that would equate to some 6,000 metres squared.
Just on that point, how many of the 36 lots were for rural residential purposes?
30. But the submitter's case, and this is my point, is that arriving at the basis for 36 being an appropriate maximum cap was not just based upon that previously lapsed consent.
I understand that.
Yeah. Okay. I won't labour that point any further then. And in my submission, the submitter has not offered up anything less than 36, and its original submission was to just rezone RRZ over the entire 28 hectares, which in theory would actually lead to a significantly higher amount of RR allotments.
Can I just ask here, just out of interest, with the lapsed consent, which was 36 dwellings?
30.
How much of that was road and recreation reserve as a percentage?
Well,
I
think we'd need to do some quick calculations to come back to you on that.
It was about 20%.
But nonetheless, some of the allotments.
It was 20%, but there were some lots that were quite big, so it wasn't an optimised yield.
No, I'm just getting those sense of what ifs.
a few lots that were around 6,000 as well, 5,000. Yeah. Yep.
So the next part of my assessment of the council's landscape reasoning is going to the point about this being perhaps not an effects-based assessment. So my quote there at 14b is pulled from Dr. Reed's rebuttal, and the bolded words state that a reduction of 26 dwellings would be a good outcome, as it would have the effect of reducing the density of development and would potentially allow clustering. Now, in my submission, that's effectively an argument that less density is better. And I refer to the evidence produced by Mr. Skelton and the additional plans he's about to put before the Commission, which actually show an assessment, visibility assessment, of the difference between 26 and 36 allotments. Paragraph C there, again, I think we've already sort of talked about this point, about the different yield calculations you could get to. But Dr. Reed's analysis also refers to and relies on the existing subdivision consent over the site, which derives 26 residential allotments. Now, my point in that paragraph is that whilst that is the existing environment, on the council's evidence, the existing environment or the nature of existing consents is actually one of a number of relevant matters in any rezoning request in this PDP. And I finish off there by saying that this is not a case of the submitter wishing to springboard off the existing resource consent of the site, but rather seeking to preserve the status quo of developable rights under both the PDP and ODP. And that, again, that status quo of developable rights under the ODP and PDP is based upon a theoretical yield. Now, my final paragraph there, D, subparagraph D, I don't think I need to go through this in detail, but the key point to take out of this is that Mr. Buxton's rebuttal refers to that lapsed consent from 2004 and stating that the layout of that was very condensed. Now, in my submission, Dr. Reid has provided the same analysis, and I think that that opinion on the density or that subdivision being very condensed is, I guess, a matter of subjective opinion. The key point is, as Mr. Ferguson will also refer to, is that that was an example of a compliant subdivision. So now I turn to the submitter's case, which is commenced on page 5-6 of my submissions. And I've already set this out as an overview for the Commission, but the principal basis for the submitter's offering up of a total cap on site is actually based upon landscape effects-based evidence. Now, Mr. Skelton's summary evidence shows that the site can absorb the level of development sought by the submitter based upon landscape grounds, and he concludes that the difference between 26 lots being the existing environment and 36 lots over the site would actually have a very low to negligible effect on the landscape. And then Mr. Ferguson's summary evidence relies upon that landscape finding and concludes that development of this land into a, that you read a 36 lot yield would be a more efficient use of the land resource. Now, as already stated in the submissions, I submit that a deduction of some 33%, or it might be actually 32%, for open space and roads is not actually an appropriate deduction for calculating yield in a rural residential environment. That figure is the same as that which is used for urban land development, and that's quite a different scenario to calculate what might happen in a rural residential zone. And I've already stated the reasons for that, being that the size of those allotments create internal immunity by their very nature. And there might be a range of appropriate access and internal roading options. We don't know what that might look like. So in my submission, taking a yield calculation from 15 hectares of ODP and PDP RR zoning, that would get you to 37.5 allotments. Deducting 1.5 of those to allow for road access gets you to 36. And in my submission, that is the baseline for developable rights, which is in the PDP as notified. And therefore, without the submitter having offered up something less than that, I don't believe that there is scope for a reduction in those rights. Now, I've taken a quote out of the Council's strategic planning units, so the 42A report on this hearing stream. And the key part there is bolded that notwithstanding improvements to the administration of the policy and law framework which have been made in the PEP, there were not any existing zones removed or altered through the notified PEP. The principal reason for this was to acknowledge the long-standing development rights in these zones and the likelihood that the future environment that this will create will be distinctly different from other rural areas. Now, second half of my page 7 just briefly talks to a clarification about the existing environment. I don't think I need to traverse that in any more detail, but I did notice that I think the section 223 certification may have somehow been omitted from Mr. Ferguson's evidence in chief, where it was supposed to be attached to. So I appended it to my legal submissions, just to show that in accordance with section 125 of the Act, that existing consent over the site has been given effect to. And as I've already said, that's one of a number of relevant matters for consideration in a rezoning request. Now, the final page of my submissions just briefly traverses some outstanding matters, and that being mostly a response to the council's evidence in chief from Mr. Mander, the traffic expert. In my submission, Mr. Mander's calculations as to increased traffic are somewhat ambiguous, and Mr. Ferguson also talks about this in the summary, but basically Mr. Mander's conclusion is about the effects of an additional 25 allotments, but it's unclear what that additional amount is calculated against, what the baseline is. Perhaps it might be the existing consent of 26, or perhaps it's a theoretical yield of 36, I'm not sure. But in any event, that Mr. Mander did not provide rebuttal evidence in light of the submitter's refined proposal to go down to 36 allotments. So there's currently no traffic evidence before the Commission which states that there are traffic concerns in respect of a total yield of 36 allotments over this site. Now, my second point here is that that proposition is further supported by the fact that, as I've already stated, 36 allotments on this site is a baseline yield, or right, theoretically. And I have had a look back through the Section 32 reports, and there appear to be no traffic concerns raised in those analyses when the council determined to roll over the 15 hectares of RR zoning. And finally and Mr. Ferguson will talk you through this in more detail, but in his summary statement, there are a number of other mechanisms within the plan and within council's means to ensure that appropriate traffic and transportation concerns are addressed at stage of future subdivision and development. My submission requiring further traffic evidence to support an increase from the existing consent of 26 to a limitation of 36 would be unnecessary. And relating back to my existing right or theoretical yield of 36, I submit that there is no burden of proof on the submitter in this case to demonstrate the appropriateness of traffic effects from the revised zoning. So that concludes the key parts of my submissions. I think I've already talked you through adequately the two appendices, being the revised plan and the Section 223 certification. If there are any questions on those submissions, I'm happy to answer them, or otherwise we can get to summary evidence.
When you have a situation like this where the zone has been applied to some of the land and you're seeking to extend it, to what extent should we take into account the objectives and policies that apply to the rural residential zone and how it is applied as in the proposed plan?
So a consideration of the rezoning request against the PDP objectives and policies pertaining to the requested zoning, from memory, is one relevant matter of the council's 13 or so relevant considerations in a rezoning request. And I believe that Ferguson has done such an analysis in his evidence.
Yes. What I'm getting at, though, part of the land is already zoned, so part of the land clearly, from the council's point of view, satisfied those objectives and policies.
I can see it.
Well, no, not assumption, it must be a matter of fact, because they've notified it that way. I'm just wondering whether the other 12 matters that the council listed are really relevant if the objectives and policies are met for the extension of the land.
Well,
unless the matters which are incorporated in those objectives and policies, of course.
So, sorry, I'm not sure how I'm understanding the question. Is your question that the only relevant consideration...
Or the primary consideration.
Or the, your question is the primary consideration is the whether the rezoning proposal achieves the rural residential objectives and policies.
Hmm.
And that
and obviously
is a question
the,
on
and obviously the more strategic ones.
Also, and yes, so I think that's one of the other 12 as well, is
yes.
The other higher order... And in my submission, I think we've traversed this in detail, particularly in topic 12 hearings, about the raft of relevant considerations in a rezoning request. And I think because of the nature of the PDT objective still being in a state of flux, it's appropriate to assess a rezoning request not only against the provisions of the zone which you're seeking, but also within the context of the broader plan framework.
Okay, thank you. Did you have any questions?
Okay, thank you, Commissioners. I will now hand up summary statements for Mr. Skelton.
Yes, Nick. But then the slope of Camp Hill is a bit different, and it's variable between 1 and 3 and 1 and 4. So I think if you were to say 1 and 4 being the, not to go beyond anything steeper than 1 and 4, you'd be restricting everything to the flatter parts of the terrace.
So the slope of the terrace was...
Sorry, the slope of the terrace is 1 and 2. The terrace face?
The face of the terrace.
The face of the terrace, yeah.
The top of the terrace.
The escarpment, yeah.
Yes, that makes sense.
Yes, yes, Scott.
And Camp Hill being the hill at the rear of the zone.
That's right. It's variable, approximately 1 and 3 to 1 and 4.
Although the zone boundary tends to be at the foot of that slope.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the zone boundary would be the appropriate setback there anyway.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll start at paragraph 3. Following the preparation of my statement of evidence, I review the following statements. The rebuttal evidence prepared by Robert Buxton, dated the 7th of July, 2017, and the rebuttal evidence prepared by Dr. Marion Reed, dated the 7th of July, 2017. The subject submission seeks to amend the boundaries of an existing rural residential zone near the Paradise Glenorchy Road. The site is partly zoned rural residential and partly zoned rural, and is within an outstanding natural landscape. It's difficult to follow the logic which led to the delineation of this rural residential zoning, as the zone boundary extends onto the southern face of the alluvial terrace and does not take in the flatter lands between the terrace face and the base of Camp Hill. The existing rural residential zone is approximately 15 hectares in area. The subject submission seeks to realign the zone boundary to increase its area to approximately 28 hectares. The proposed alignment would more closely follow the site's topographic features and better align it with the zone boundaries originally proposed by Messrs. Kirkland and Honak. I've taken that from Mr. Buxton's evidence. The proposal also seeks to provide a setback of 20 meters from the zone boundary to ensure the quality, character, and visual amenity provided by the terrace base and Camp Hill features maintained, to limit the maximum number of dwellings within the rural residential zone to 36. A number which, as I understand, is a level of development which is anticipated by the existing zone, and to limit the maximum building height to 5.5 meters, which will reduce the visual effects of built development. There has been some debate as to the potential yield of the existing 15 hectares of the rural residential zone, and I concur that the potential year yield is closer to 36 rather than 26, and that a 96% yield is a more feasible scenario. I've taken out the, as demonstrated by the 2004 consent. An existing subdivision consent allows for 26 allotments on the flatlands between the terrace face and the base of Camp Hill. The proposed zone boundary would take in much of this consented development. I've prepared a model, and I'll refer you to my attachments now, which gives an indication of how this consented development could appear in terms of patterning and density. I built the existing consent, and then I added to the model of potential design, which is attachment BB, which portrays sort of a potential scenario in terms of patterning and density. It replicates the pattern of what's already approved under the existing consent. So I added an extra 10 dwellings into there to see how the patterning would actually look. I then studied this model in isolation, just being in the software that created the model, as well as applying it to its context in Google Earth, which I've demonstrated a couple of just screenshots and attachment CC. This has provided to be a useful tool in confirming my original assessment of the submission that the increased number of lots in the area of the rural residential zone will not exacerbate the anticipated effects of the existing rural residential zone and subdivision consent. In her 7th July 2017 rebuttal evidence, Dr. Reed considered that if the zone were to increase in area as proposed, that it would be appropriate to allow for 26 dwellings within the proposed zone and not 36. She stated that this would be a good outcome, and as it would reduce the density of development and would potentially allow clustering, which in turn would mitigate the effects of development. However, she offers little evidence to support her considerations, especially in terms of clustering. I'm not sure how reducing the density would encourage clustering. In terms of density, the maximum density of the rural residential zone is intended to be a maximum of one household per every 4,000 square meters. 26 lots allowed within a 15 hectare area of the existing zone would result in a density of one household for every 5,700 square meters. The proposal would increase the area of the zone to approximately 28 hectares, allowing for 36 lots within that area, resulting in a density of one household for every 7,700 square meters. I accept that this study does not account for roads, setbacks, or services, but I consider it a useful analysis in determining the likely resulting density of the proposal. I consider that the proposal will not introduce densities which are not anticipated in this location, and will enable less dense residential development that enabled by a strict application of the zone standards and then strike out for as demonstrated by the 2004 consent. Dr. Reed considers the less allotments, 26 versus 36 in the proposed zone, will potentially allow for clustering, and I'm unsure how she's determined this. I consider that less lots would likely result in buildings being located farther apart to achieve a higher density of spaciousness and rural amenity than that zone. I agree with Dr. Reed that two important landscape features of the site and surrounding landscape are the terrace face and Camp Hill. And the proposed zone is shown in the Darby Partners plan, which you have before you, closely follows the edge of the terrace face and the base of Camp Hill. I consider that a 20-meter setback from the zone boundary adequately addresses the concerns Dr. Reed has regarding the potential adverse effects of residential development on these features. Overall, the difference between 26 lots and 36 lots, when considered within the conditions relevant to height of buildings and setbacks from land features, will result in a very low to manageable change in effect beyond that which is anticipated by the existing zone and resource consent.
Just in terms of your paragraph 11, summary there, are there any policies in the rural residential zone that require clustering?
Not that I'm aware of. And Mr. Ferguson is just confirming.
I just wanted to be fair with me. Your model in attachment BB has the same boundaries as this revised version?
I've used those boundaries, yes, but I haven't included that line. The line that I built the model on is, was based on the previous proposed line, which has been amended slightly.
Yeah,
so
it's tiny. I was just checking. We have all these iterations, and I want to look final one.
Everything which is shown in this model would be contained within the proposed zone.
That one. Okay.
Yes.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. May Mr. Musk-Skelton be excused?
Yes.
I'll now hand out Mr. Ferguson's summaries.
Based on these latest statements, the scope of that is not an agreement that the Council has now considered. My evidence in chief supports the amendment to the Rural Residential Zone of Common Hill to better align its zone with topography and to recognise an appropriate area of development as established through prior subdivision. My evidence in chief proposes that the realignment of the zone boundary be subject to additional controls to manage the effects of future subdivision development, including a restriction on the maximum development potential for the zone of 36 lots, restricting maximum building height to 5.5 metres, and imposing a 20 metre building setback from the zone boundaries. The rebuttal evidence for the Council now supports the amended zone boundary. The intent of the 20 metre setback for buildings from the zone boundary, stroke, terrace, escarpment, edge, and the 5.5 metre height restriction. The outstanding matters from the Council's rebuttal evidence relate to the intensity of the development within the zone, which is the 36 versus 26 lots, and the management of the building setback from the top of the western terrace escarpment. One further submission has been made against the Mount Christina submission by Bernie Knapp for Strathera. This does not oppose the adjustments of the boundaries of the zone, and no evidence has been filed in relation to this hearing. In dealing with the setback from the escarpment edge, and subject to our earlier discussion, the rebuttal evidence by Dr. Reid considers that having a 20 metre setback from the top of the terrace escarpments would be necessary to ensure that development did not adversely affect these landforms or the views from public places. This finding is based on Dr. Reid's consideration of the site boundaries and the terrace escarpments only approximately related along the western boundaries. The proposed 20 metre zone setback or boundary setback over the entire site is intended to provide a setback from the edge of the terrace escarpment. However, based on the plans that were attached to my evidence in chief, if I can understand how that might not appear. The submitter has prepared an additional plan, which we've been through earlier, showing the proposed rural residential boundary overlaid on contours, including the identified top of terrace. This plan shows the zone boundary as being aligned either along or slightly inside the top of the terrace escarpment. The 20 metre zone setback proposed by evidence in chief and fear would provide necessary protection of visual liberty with the same status as the building restriction area proposed in the Republic of Mr. Buxton, i.e., we're in breach of that building as a non compliant activity. If the zone boundary is related to the top of the terrace escarpment, then a zone setback is just as effective or efficient to incorporate into the zone rules
and has the benefit of not requiring the formulation of an additional overlay on the PIMDAX. Intensity of development. The council's position set out in the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Buxton and Dr. Reed is that the maximum yield for the zone should be restricted to 26 lots, not 36, as sought and revised and contained within my chair. Mr. Buxton considers that the consent granted of 36 lots resulted in the level of development that was very condensed for the remote location of the site. The landscape evidence by Dr. Reed also supports the view that the zone should provide for an overall yield of 26 lots rather than 36, as requested in the submission, as it would have the effect of reducing density of development and potentially allow for clustering. Dr. Reed also records council allowance for the roading infrastructure as allowing for a realistic yield of 0.68% of the gross site area, which over 15 hectares of rural residential zone is now defined to equate to 26 lots. And from a planning perspective, I see things slightly differently. In particular, the 68% or 0.68% yield estimate is not appropriate in my view within the rural residential environment. And the 32% reduction for open space and vehicle access is a scheme normally applied to the urban environment. The increasing the size of the zone from 15 to 28 hectares with the same yield will further lower the intensity of the development and create much more opportunity for open space within and between lots. Objective 3254 of the revised proposal provides that the finite capacity of rural areas to absorb residential development is considered so as to protect the qualities of the landscape. The evidence for the council does not challenge their location and the shape of the zone as being appropriate for the quality of the landscape. The greater the reduction of the development potential, the less capable residential development will affect the finite capacity of the resource. In achieving the purpose of the Act, Section 7B requires particular regard to the efficient use and development of natural and physical resources. A limitation on the development capacity of 36 lots provides for a more efficient use of the available and the finite land resource, while also having regard to the values of the surrounding landscape through the ability to create open space within and between lots. And as identified within my evidence of chief, a yield of 36 lots across 28 hectares of this land provides an average size of 7,000 square metres. Based on these measures, I consider the amended zone with development capacity limited to 36 dwellings will better achieve the relevant objective of the PDP and of the purpose of the Act than 26. On traffic, the initial concerns raised in the traffic evidence by Mr. Mander related to the potential for the zone to create an additional 25 lots. Now, on that point, I've just not clear how he's done that calculation, that's on a 36 or a 26 lot basis, are not explored further in his statement of rebuttal evidence dated 7th of July in relation to the revised proposal to restrict development capacity to 36 lots. And in relation to traffic impacts, I note the revised proposal would not result in any further traffic that could be anticipated to be in compliance with the provision being undertaken in accordance with the current popular district plan zone. The council levies contributions for transportation infrastructure under its policy on financial development contributions under the LGA. The purpose of this network-wide charge is to provide a framework for imposing contributions on any further investment in the council's assets or about high growth. Any upgrades required to the Glenorchy Paradise Road as a result of subdivision within this zone can be provided for either through the above local government regime or as part of the condition imposing on the subdivision. I note that the matters of discretion over subdivision within Chapter 27 on the revised proposal includes roading access. Any condition imposed on the subdivision under Sections 108 to 220 of the Act can require works within an adjoining road network if that is necessary to mitigate the effects of that proposed activity. Because of these mechanisms, there is no need to introduce any further rules relating to this zone. And finally, I just note that this approach also has the benefits of ensuring that the subdivision pays or mitigates the effects attributed to that activity and does not include the wider upgrades that might be necessary to the road network for about five consistent traffic flows. So that's my summary statement, and I wondered if I could just refer the Commission to my Appendix 5 of the Maintenance in Check. Now, on the last page of Appendix 5, I have included the relevant objectives and policies, or the relevant objectives, I should say, from Chapter 22, which relate to the rural lifestyle zone and the rural residential zone. And I just wanted to pick up and address the point that the Commission usually was asking earlier around those provisions. The relevant objective, I think, that in terms of the existence of the zone on the landscape, if you like, is 22.2.1. I've included my version here, but I don't see any material differences potentially in how that might be interpreted on this side. But it talks about the district's landscape quality, character, and visual amenity values being maintained and enhanced while enabling rural living opportunities in areas that can absorb the development.
I think Mr. Ferguson, that is consistent with the reply version that Mr. Barr provided.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
So,
well, that's helpful.
Yes, there's an agreement between you and the council there anyway. Yes.
Oh, gosh, great. I did lose track. I think that, returning to your point, if the council is satisfied at the time of notification of the zone, that the extent of the original zoning over that land has met that policy, then I don't see any material differences between the characteristics of the landscape on that terraced landform between the land that has been zoned and the land that hasn't been zoned. So I think which is your point, I think, that if you made a view or reached an opinion that the zoning is capable of satisfying the objectives and policies of the rural residential zone on the current area, then I can't see, based on the landscape evidence and just looking at the landform itself, how a different conclusion could be reached in respect of the balance of the area of that same terrace, which has the same characteristics from topographical, natural, and physical resources perspective.
Just getting back to this setback, I was thinking about it as we'd gone along. Is the top of that escarpment sufficiently identifiable that we can simply just refer to that? So the front came to the front end of the slope, isn't it?
Yeah. The subdivision maps, the subdivision plan that I've seen, usually include an underlay, if you like, of the contours. And those contours, as you often see with topographical surveys, do identify the top of bank, the top of bank along the edge. So it's quite distinct, both when you look at it on the site, but also as it has been surveyed. I think from a planning perspective, and I'm just thinking of future administrators of the plan, it would be preferable, in my view, if the zoning boundary was related to that from the beginning, because the measurements can be made from the zone boundary. That data can be extracted from the council's system, and it removes any element of the doubt, and people know from the beginning what it is that that's in there, whether it's under control.
I was just wondering whether, in practical terms, if you say 20 metres, but if it's distinct enough, it might be 19 or half, it might be 21 and a half, but it wouldn't sort of be within those parameters anyway. The objective of the setback would be achieved.
Yeah,
I think split hairs a little bit. Yeah.
I think we are, yes, and I think that we're probably being quite cautious, but it's also trying to be, you know, trying to think of future administrators of the plan in a way that can just be, you know, if it can be done for the zone boundary, then that would be my preference, because it's easier to do for future plan references. It doesn't then rely on somebody having to go and do a topographic survey, or should rely on that a bit of additional data, make an interpretation.
Well, it is dependent on you're getting it accurate now when you set that zone boundary.
It does, yeah.
So how do you do that?
Well, I mean, I've got confidence in the data that's been provided and how I've witnessed it from my own observations on the ground, but that top of terraces recently identified all the terms of the topographic survey, and then that's been used as the basis for delimitating that
information. I'm just thinking, if you're confident the data's good enough to do it, I'll identify that now, it would also be good enough to identify it later. Because it's the same information for the same purpose.
Yeah, I guess it's just the question of who holds that data.
The other concern that I wonder if you've considered is the potential for unforeseen consequences by creating a zone boundary that cuts out small parts of the site. That then might in future lead to expectations of those small parts of the sites having their own particular uses.
How do you define uses?
Well, given that the definition of site in the plan says you can create separate sites along zone boundaries as of right, is that creating a circumstance in the future where there's a small site, albeit steep, but there's a section 85 argument, we have to be able to use it for something.
Section 85, yeah. Well,
wouldn't it be better to just say it's unusable now? It's in the zone, but it's unusable.
I guess there would be a residual area of swimmers that exist between the current legally defined parcel and the edge of that escarpment, and the extent of those slivers can be seen in the two bites, but it also, I know that it exists on the western edge. There's a very, if you actually interrogate at a much greater scale and reduce the line width, you can get very small slivers
along that entire edge. Well.
So there are very small differences between map on the top of the terrace and the conditional boundary. And so you've understood the logic, I suppose, that we've taken, that it's either going to the conditional boundary if it's on the inside or at the top of the terrace. So yes, that would create a residual area, and that potentially could, I'm not sure how, somebody mount an argument that they want to then use a very, very, very small parcel for any purpose. I think the area is of such a size that I don't know that it has any material difference on the use of the land. But I appreciate having said that, and pulling back a step, I mean, having said that, I could also see equal merit in having a slope-based control, but I think that, which is fine, but I think then you still need to be able to have a setback. In order to address the concerns of the way that Dr. Reed, still need to have a setback from the top of the scalp.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Crawford, I don't have any other questions either. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
you, Commissioners. I don't intend to present a closing, so. Unless there are any further questions, that concludes our presentation time.
In that case, I will adjourn until next Monday at 9:30.
Thank you.
Maybe. Yes.